Okay, our next speaker is Paul Carr, and I've known Paul for quite a while. He's in my hometown of Bedford, Mass, back when I first met him, but I met him through the ASA list of members, and he's in Bedford, New Hampshire now, so it sounds kind of close, but it's a little further away. But, you know, Paul's a guy, he's a bit of a role model for my retirement, but I wanted to make sure I never tried to do as much as Paul does in retirement, because that would exhaust me. And so, you know, nobody gives more talks or thinking harder than Paul in retirement. So I'm looking forward to hearing him talk about automation, which I know our keynote speaker, Nigel Cameron, talked a little bit about. I had one chart in my talk, and I think Paul will do a little better treatment here.
Right, I'm going to pick up on some of the issues that Cameron raised this morning. But it turns out there's a study, and I'll quote it, which says that by 2030, about a third of American workers are going to have to find a new job due to the fact that their jobs have been eliminated by automation, because a lot of times automation can do a better job on a specific task than we humans can. And what role can religion play? And I'm going to point out that this displacement is not new, and religion has played a major role in the past, and it can still in the future. So here we have the importance of automation in the Olympics. This was the Korean Olympics, and you can see the Olympic flame is being passed on to a humanoid robot. And it said that robots in the Olympics were ready to ski, paint, clean at South Korea's 218 Olympics. And they wanted to showcase their robotics. They had like 80 robots there for a whole range of roles, including delivering refreshments to the people and the athletes in the Olympic Village. And they were not a humanoid robot; they would have been more functional robots. Are we giving our autonomy to robots, as shown here? And I think you can say yes when you see this robot. You can see the seat being installed in this Tesla Model 3 economy electric vehicle. You don't see any humans here. Many of our manufacturing jobs, particularly in the automotive industry, are being performed by robots. And because AI exceeds human capabilities, up to one-third of the American workforce will have to switch to new occupations by 2030, according to the McKinsey Global Institute recent automation report. That's a 28% decrease in jobs per decade. And it may affect some of us. But we've gone through this before. In 1790, 90% of our population worked on farms or agricultural-related jobs. And over two centuries, we're down to 2.6%. That's a 4% decrease per decade. That's a lot slower, and we had a lot more time to adapt than the present challenge, from 28% decrease in jobs per decade for a 4% decrease. Now, of course, and we've lost something along the way. In 1790, we had resilient family farms growing their own food. Today, we have high-tech farms, which are dependent on the economy and government subsidies. I know in New Hampshire, our government is very concerned that only about 3% of our food is grown locally in New Hampshire. The rest is trucked in. There are no railroads going into New Hampshire. So if whatever reason, diesel fuel would not be available to truck food in, we'd starve. And they're therefore encouraging local farmers and farmers markets. Here's a little poem by Emily Dickinson. Back in the days when most people had their own vegetable gardens, the product of my farm are those sufficient for my own, and here or there a benefit upon a neighbor's bin. So, more resilient lifestyle in the past. And now we have this problem of an increasing gap between productivity. You can see productivity has been rising virtually linearly since 1955, and it's even shot up a little bit since 2000. That's the good news. Well, the good news is that private non-farm payrolls were increasing pretty much at the same rate. But since 2000, as you can see, payrolls have leveled off for the most part. They've only increased a half a percent as opposed to productivity. Well, who's been gaining from this productivity?
Steve Jobs.
Pardon? Steve Jobs, that's right. Multi-millionaires like Steve Jobs or Bill Gates or Zuckerberg and so forth. That's where the money's been going, and the average person hasn't been giving. You see this large gap increasing between the average person and the entrepreneurs. And this reminded me of, you know, back when we went from agriculture to, in 1970 to the present, tractors, dial phones, ATMs. However, new skill jobs evolved over two centuries, but in a little over a decade, we see AI has pushed automation to a near tipping point where machines finally master traits that had kept human workers irreplaceable. One example would be radiologists that analyze x-rays. And they've been largely replaced by automated automation that can actually do a better job identifying certain tumors or growth than a human can do. So this reminds me, particularly this increasing gap between productivity and wages, reminds me of, this was cited this morning, Karl Marx this morning, again, when workers were exploited by the capitalists, and that led Karl Marx to write, "Workers of the world arise, you have nothing to lose but your chains." And we know the result of Marxism was the communist revolution in Russia in 1917. And that didn't really end till the end of the Cold War. Well, what happened in the United States? Instead of a state socialism in Russia, what did we have in the United States what movements in the United States constrained the power of the capitalists?
Unions,
that's right. The unions and also the antitrust. And right now, the unions have been pretty well squelched by globalization, by shipping jobs overseas, by bringing in foreign companies that hire non-union workers, and also by some of our latest Supreme Court decisions. For example, Citizens United gives corporations unlimited ability to buy advertisement to elect representatives that are basically bought out by big business. Just recently there was a Supreme Court decision which was against the unions. Well, what might happen? I think we're going to have serious problems. I think we're already seeing it. But let's get back to a little history. I'm familiar with the dairy industry. I grew up in northern Vermont, which is big dairy country. And we noticed that the number of dairy farms back in 1970, and using this data, was the order of 650 dairy farms. And the average size of the dairy farm, that's the blue, was, say, roughly 20 cows. And now we're going toward the order of 100 cows, hundreds of cows, even in some cases thousands of cows per farm, yet the number of milk cows, number of operation or the number of farms has gone down substantially. So we're getting very large, high-tech farms. And just to symbolize what used to happen, my grandfather, Irving Carr, milked about a dozen cows by hand, carried that milk into these large pails. He carried them onto his pickup truck and drove them personally to the creamery in town. And now we have robotic milking machines where everything is done without touch by human hands. And notice particularly the tubing. Early milking machines, the farmer still had to carry the milk to the milk cows, but now it's all piped electronically into a large container, which in the farm, and then that container, the milk is transferred onto a milk truck. And these are expensive, though, That can be the order of $50,000 to $100,000. So you need a large farm to pay for this automation. But the milk is done untouched by human hands. Well, this is a farm, just to give you some idea how this played out in a farm where I grew up. This is the Parsons Farm, established in 1919. The present owner and a family friend is the shepherd Chester Parsons, whom I've known all his life, leading his small flock of sheep. And here he is harvesting some hay for it to feed his sheep during the winter. And here's a picture of Chester when he was a little boy. This is from his web page. And you can see Chester with his grandfather, William. Now, as William purchased the farm in 1919, and it was enough, the income from that farm enabled him to raise nine children, the youngest of which, Milton, inherited the farm. And Milton and his father would milk about 20 cows. And they bought milking machines in 1945, which enabled Milton to carry on the farm when his father died. But he later had to sell off his dairy cows because the creamery would no longer pick up those milk cans. He had to invest in a large refrigerated tank, which he couldn't afford given the income that he had. Well, eventually this farm passed on to Chester. And how did Chester maintain this farm for now almost a century? Well, Chester fortunately went to the University of Vermont, and where he learned sheep farming, and he got a job working for the University of Vermont Extension Service. That provided him an income which enabled him to maintain the farm. I must say the income from the farm is minimal. There's no market these days for wool. It's all been replaced by synthetics. So his only source of income is selling lamb. And he tells me that each lamb to butcher and cut up the meat and sort of costs him almost $100. So his net profit per lamb is only maybe $300 or $400, and he doesn't have that many lambs. So he's dependent on his retirement income to still maintain But the key thing that kept him and his farm in the family and going was the fact that he had an education. And the importance of education, I think, is very well illustrated, particularly today, in the differential pay, let's say, between a high school dropout whose actual earnings has gone down over time versus someone with a higher than a bachelor's degree. You can see the tremendous differential. The differential between a high school dropout and someone with an advanced degree is relatively small in roughly 1980, which you can see that's expanded tremendously in the last few years. And this has resulted in large differentials in income between the top 10% who have a typical income of a quarter of a million, whereas the bottom, most people, their income is roughly in the poverty level, only $30,000 a year. But this is going to get worse, with AI, because where are the new jobs? The new jobs are going to be servicing robots, and you need an education. That's not something you can learn in high school. You need advanced skills, some computer knowledge, and as a matter of fact, the president of Northeastern has written a book called Robot Proof Higher Education in the Age of AI. He said he needs to educate the next generation of college students to invent, create, and discover, filling needs given that even the most sophisticated robots cannot do. He said we need both computer skills, but also communication skills, history, psychology, philosophy, religion, which you learn in the humanities. So that's what we need, how to educate people and things that to be creative, to be entrepreneurial, and that's how people will still have jobs and important things to do. Well, let's look at what happened. Our Cameron this morning talked about the Industrial Revolution in England in particular. Particularly, Europe's population had nearly doubled between 1750 and 1850 due to lower death rates and increased food supply. But cities grew because of decreasing farmland and increased population. Also, people were working in the coal mines to provide the growing railroads. And then factories attracted people to cities to find work. But as we heard, there was a lot of child labor, and even skilled jobs went down because the jobs were tailored that even children could do them. Cities grew faster than the basic infrastructure, so roads, housing, clean water, and sewers were inadequate. This led to crowding, dirt, and disease. And the result, there was a lot of rioting. People were rioting in the streets. We've had demonstrations ourselves in the last few years. Marches, fortunately, have all been peaceful. But John Wesley in the 1700s preached successfully to thousands of these displaced people, both in the city streets and in the open fields. And he was a great organizer. Once that they were converted, they kept the commitment to become a Christian. He organized them into small groups, and he saw that they were educated. And also, for his ministers, the Bible was not enough for Wesley's ministers. He trained them to have a knowledge of the world's great literature, including science and religion. He was also up in the latest science of his day. Well, this tradition carried on a century later when, here's my dad, at the time, living with his family on a dairy farm in Hardwick, Vermont. This is 1919, the same year that William Parsons bought his farm that supported his family. Well, this dairy farm supported this large family. This is my grandfather, Irving. But my dad had a calling to become a minister, a Methodist minister, and he needed an education as per John Wesley. Turned out his father... father's father was a Jewett Carr, was a Seventh-day Adventist lay preacher who had no college education, and Irving didn't think college education was particularly necessary. And so my dad, when he went to Bates College, that's where he did his undergraduate, had no support from his family, earned his way, borrowed money, and after he graduated, he had a job as a school teacher to pay his debt, and then he went on to Boston University School of Theology to became a Methodist minister. So there again, education was the key for his getting away from the farm, away from education, and he had pastorates in northern Vermont and one in Ipswich. He had a pastorate in Ipswich, which is a few miles from here, and it was then that I met my, what is now my late wife. She was living in Beverly Farms, and my her family's still here. My brother-in-law is here today. As a matter of fact, part of her large family, part of my late wife's family. So that's how my family, my father, started in Vermont and moved to Massachusetts, mainly through education. It was education that gave him that opportunity. Well, my dad kept, in spite of this differential, the problem he had with getting an education and not getting any support from his father, he maintained a good relationship with his dad. And my daughter Kirsten, who stayed today, discovered this letter that my dad wrote to his father shortly before his father passed away. My dad wrote, "The journey and development of the human soul involves consideration from everlasting to everlasting. Each person represents the outcome of countless preceding generations, an unbroken line of experience. Spiritual strength has to be measured by burdens carried, resistances encountered, and frustrations survived. In the experience of one generation to another, I can see that it is not so much the events that have significance, but the emotional interpretation of them. The main objective is love. All things happen for good when love prevails." This is a paraphrase of Paul's letter to the Romans in the 8th chapter, where he says, "All things work together for the good for those who love God." Well, and religion plays important roles in personal identity and meaning as one's jobs change. This is John Wesley was able to do this to the displaced workers in his time. And also religion has played a big role in education. Religious communities have established universities like the Methodist founded Boston University to educate ministers. Similarly, the Congregationalists founded Harvard in 1636, so they didn't have to send their potential ministers back to England to get educated. There are 28 Jesuit colleges in the United States, and as we know, the ASA meets at evangelical colleges all across the United States, such as Gordon College right here, which has grown tremendously in the last 50 years. Well, another example is that this Jesuit, Gregory Boyle, who wrote this book, Tattoos of the Heart, and basically he has basically founded Homeboy Industries, providing employment and job counseling to Los Angeles gang members. Actually, he's even done a bakery, and particularly interested in finding employment for young boys when they get out of prison. But churches, basically local churches, I think some of you may be involved with local churches who provide funds, tutoring, and mentoring support to local schools in nearby poor neighborhoods. This is something that I think churches should rise to this challenge, because as is the tendency, if you're in a rich, well-to-do, middle-class a neighborhood like around here would be Lexington, Concord. There are good schools, but then we have relatively poor schools in a lot of migrants in, say, Lowell and Lawrence and Manchester, New Hampshire, so forth. That's an opportunity, a missionary that many churches are stepping up to and could do more. And that's how churches, as did Gregory Poole, whom almost single-handedly headed this Homeboy Ministries as way of helping the disadvantaged peoples. I might mention, by the way, as I move on to what we might do as robots do all our work. One proposal, and this is being investigated, is a minimum income for all those who would meet a means test, or a basic income for all citizens. Pilot programs, like there's a pilot program going on in Ontario, Canada. I have a special viewgraph, if we have time at the end, during the question period, to give you more detail on that. But funds could come from limiting all other unemployment welfare services. But I guess the economic issue, of course, is where does the money come from? Well, one example of where money is being raised. This is a program being advocated in Congress right now by the Citizens Climate Lobby, a revenue neutral carbon fee plus dividend. This is largely a fee on fossil fuels whose carbon dioxide emissions are warming our climate. And this would stimulate the development of green, non-carbon emitting energy technology. But what would happen to this money? The proposal is, and economists have looked into this, that a family of four could receive an income of $2,000 per year from the carbon fee, stimulating the economy and creating millions of jobs. Because we know the average person spends money locally on goods and services, opposed to, well, people like Bill Gates. He's got a mansion on Martha's Vineyard, for example. I don't know if anybody knows Martha's Vineyard, but as I understand it, there's so many mansions there that the average policeman can't afford to live there. That's where a lot of rich people spend their money, but the average person spends it on local goods and services, which makes jobs in their local area. Well, this sort of argument could go toward funding this basic income, and people say, well, you know, really, what is the cost of people living in poverty? Well, it turns out if you don't get a good education, the chances of your going to prison are very high. And it turns out that the cost of incarcerating a person in a prison is comparable to the cost of sending someone to a private university like Harvard. You know, so, and it turns out the United States, by the way, has the largest percentage of people in prison than any other developed country. So, you know, a lot of conservative economics don't price in the cost of poverty. So that's one of the arguments for this basic income, a pilot program in Ontario, Canada. And there's an interesting article which I can go into in more detail. But let me just giving you my summary, which is helping the 30% automation displaced workers. It'll be on my webpage, mirrorofnature.org, in a few days. But religion plays important roles in personal identity and meaning as one job changes. And if people, I've had family members that have been unemployed looking for jobs in the course of several years, find a new job. It's not easy. There's a book called, What Color Is Your Parachute, by the way? It's a guidance for job changes. But I think churches can play a major role here, as did John Wesley. And then we need a robot-proof education, education which emphasizes creativity, human creativity. And as Paul defined it in his chapter 2:12-2, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. That's what creativity really is, that you may prove what is good, acceptable, and perfect will of God. So thank you, and hopefully time for a few questions. Yes?
Besides the automobile industry, which occupations are very high risk for becoming robotic or computerized?
Right, well, they're saying lawyers, for example, computers are so good at searching databases. You know, a lot of legal work is, searching databases, you know, the volumes, and now you can do that on a computer. So a lot of paralegals are losing jobs. And as I mentioned earlier, X-ray, people MDs who... radiologists. That's right. They're finding that automatic AI can do a better job at finding tumors and so forth that maybe a human would pass up. So there's an example of skilled middle class educated people being displaced by computers. There are more questions? Yeah.
So you were trying to explain this change that happened in 2000, where you had productivity and ordinary income to ordinary people
right
together until 2000, and now they're splitting.
Right.
You gave the example of how we've seen automation or technology displacing labor in farms, but most of that happened well before 2000. So what makes the kind of automation that was happening then different from the kind of automation that happens now? What makes you think that divergence is primarily due to a new kind of automation?
Yeah, it seems to be in manufacturing. Seems to be in manufacturing and in like laws, lawyers and radiologists. Example of those. These are highly skilled, educated people that are being displaced by automation.
Could you comment on the fact that we are living longer and the birth rate is going down, so the fraction of our population that's in the workforce is going down? Can you comment on that?
Yeah, well, I think, of course, there are more retired people. Like ourselves, Tim and I, who spend ourselves looking at these mega problems, these big problems, and trying to do something about it. I just wanted to, thought people might be, when we're talking about the, free to this article, free money's big test. This is the pilot program going on in Ottawa right now. Basically giving people a basic income, no strings attached. The program is expected to cost $50 million, but 4,000 people are getting $17,000 a year Canadian. And this boosts them to 75% of the poverty level. The motivation is there to lose more. And this article talks about people one woman who's getting better, she can buy better food. This gives her more energy, and she's actually going to a community college to increase her skills to get a job. She might not, if she were just barely getting by, she wouldn't be able to do that. So it's the basic income and expected to streamline the benefit system, remove rules that discourage people from working, reduce crime, bad health, poor education, other problems stem from it. And this costs us. People say that economists included several years ago that it would be too expensive compared to programs that create jobs and train people for them. This is another alternative, but when you consider the cost of incarcerating people that can't get jobs, basically getting into crime, and that costs us too, people don't really figure that in. So,
all right. Thanks, Paul. All right, so let's see.